You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of October 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Markus Hippi. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Romney and Obama meet in New York tonight for round two of the presidential debates. We discuss what have been the best and the worst performances of the presidential candidates so far and how they could improve their performances.
You raise taxes and you kill jobs. That's why the National Federation of Independent Businesses said your plan will kill 700,000 jobs. I don't want to kill jobs in this environment.
As Brazil's birth rate has been dramatically dropping, we ask what this is going to do to the country's global influence. And what to do with Greece? Should it be kept on the Eurozone or kicked out? We meet Vicky Price, author of Greekonomics, The Euro Crisis and Why Politicians Don't Get It, who is keen to keep Greece in the Euro, and who will also explain what the thing about Euro Crisis is that the politicians just don't get. I will also have Monocle's design editor Hugo MacDonald here in the studio with me. He is going to talk about his personal highlights during the almost 1 year long journey of Monocle 24.
What's one of the most favourite things we love about Korea is K-pop.
Exactly, and we're joined here by a massive troupe of K-pop fans.
All that, plus we play some music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. Indeed, all this to come, but first, let's catch up on the headlines with Bill Bingham.
Monocle 24 News. Two people have been arrested at the hospital in Birmingham where the Pakistani schoolgirl Malala Yousafzai, shot in the head by the Taliban, is being treated. Staff say they pretended to be related to her. The 14-year-old was shot by a Taliban gunman because she'd been campaigning for education for girls. Pakistan's president has described the attack as an attack on civilized people. Malala's doctors say they're impressed with her strength and resilience. She's making good progress, but she has a long way to go. But the medical director at the hospital, Dave Rosser, wouldn't discuss how she was being protected.
Security is well under control. We're very comfortable with the security measures. Obviously, I'm not going to talk about them. From what's already in the public domain, it's obvious that Malala will need reconstructive surgery, and we have international experts in that field, so it's beginning to plan for reconstructive surgery. It would be as much detail as I can tell you.
John Daly, the European Union's Commissioner for Health, has resigned after an inquiry linked him with attempts to influence tobacco laws. The EU's anti-fraud office has found a businessman from Malta had tried to use his contacts with Mr. Daly, who is also Maltese, for financial gain. The businessman had tried to influence future EU tobacco legislation. Mr. Daly has vigorously rejected the investigation's findings. US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says she takes responsibility for failures in security that led to the deaths of four Americans in Libya last month. The Benghazi assault and the Obama administration's response has become a contentious election topic, and Mrs. Clinton's comments come a day before the second presidential debate. Republican candidate Mitt Romney has accused the Obama administration of not providing adequate security to American diplomats and misrepresenting the nature of the attack, which resulted in the death of U.S. Ambassador Christopher Stevens and three others. Mrs. Clinton said that it was her job to keep diplomats safe.
So what we had to do in the State Department was keep focused not on why something happened, that was for the intelligence community to determine, but what was happening and what could happen. And that's what I was very much working on, you know, day and night, to try to make sure that we intervened with governments, we did everything we could to keep our people safe, which is my primary responsibility.
Family and lawyers for the British computer hacker accused by the US of causing damage to American military systems have welcomed Britain's refusal to extradite him. British Home Secretary Theresa May announced her decision in the House of Commons, saying there was a high risk he could kill himself. Gary McKinnon has admitted hacking into the Pentagon and NASA computers, but he said he was looking for evidence of UFOs. The 46-year-old has Asperger's syndrome, a form of autism, and is suffering from depressive illness. He's been in court over the accusations since 2002. His mother, Janice Sharp, cried with relief at the news he will not now be sent to America to face charges.
Incredibly happy. I want to say thank you, Theresa May, because it was an incredibly brave decision to stand up to another nation as strong and powerful as America is rare, and she had the guts to do it. And I always felt that she had the strength to come through and do this, and to also change the extradition treaty to bring in forums so that this hopefully won't happen to anyone else.
A US court has quashed the conviction of Osama bin Laden's former driver, who'd been jailed in Guantanamo Bay for giving material support to terrorism. The appeals court ruled Salim Hamdan's offence did not constitute a war crime. He was freed in Yemen in 2009, 2 months after being sent there from the US-run detention camp in Cuba. Former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic says he should be rewarded for reducing suffering, not accused of carrying out war crimes. He's told the court at The Hague he's a tolerant man who'd sought peace in Bosnia. Mr. Karadzic is defending himself against 10 charges of genocide and crimes against humanity during the war in the 1990s, including the Srebrenica massacre and the siege of Sarajevo. Thieves have made off with paintings by Picasso, Matisse, Monet and other famous modern artists from a museum in Rotterdam. Paintings by Gauguin, Lucian Freud and Meyer de Haan were also taken from Rotterdam's Kunsthal Museum overnight. Neither the police nor the Kunsthal have put a value on the haul, but the theft is one of the art world's most dramatic in recent years and is likely to be worth millions. That's the latest Monocle 24 News.
Thank you, Bill. It's 7 minutes past the top of the hour. That is 21:07 in Moscow, 18:07 here in London and 18:07 in Sao Paulo. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Es ist Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Ein Monocle 24 Tagat, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ei ole kosa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London. The pressure is on Barack Obama to deliver a strong performance in tonight's second presidential debate at Hofstra University on Long Island. After a lackluster performance in October 3rd's debate, the Obama team saw a drop in the polls with Republican Mitt Romney gaining. Now with 21 days to go until the election, the race is essentially deadlocked. As a preview for tonight's debate and to talk about the candidates' rhetorical strengths and weaknesses, I am joined here on Midori House Studio One by Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield, and on the line from Pittsburgh by political communications expert Dr. Gerald R. Shuster. Well, the debate in the beginning of this month was a surprise for many. Barack Obama did not do as well as he was expected to. Steve, first, do you think there has been a lot of analysis on what went wrong and what to learn from this in Obama's camp?
Oh, yes, there has. From pretty much the moment he came off stage, he knew that he hadn't performed that well. And then I think when he reviewed the footage the following day, he wasn't involved that night with discussions within his own team. He went off, had dinner. Next day, he watched the footage again and thought, oh, God, actually, no, I really was bad, wasn't I? So you've already seen, in a sense, with Joe Biden's performance in the vice presidential debate, the sort of performance that the Obama team are hoping that the man himself will be able to recreate in the next two debates, where Obama was quite quiet and diffident and mumbling and defensive. Biden was quite the opposite. He was gregarious, he was big, he was loud, he was, he defended what the Obama-Biden team had done. So you will see a bit of that. However, the one problem that Obama will have tonight is that the town hall debate is very different from the first debate. It's more chatty. It's more let's sit down and talk rather than boom, 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 I think you're lying.
Well, let's go back to the beginning of October. Let's have the first clip. This is from October the 3rd.
You raise taxes and you kill jobs. That's why the National Federation of Independent Businesses said your plan will kill 700,000 jobs. I don't want to kill jobs in this environment. Let me make one more point.
Okay, let me answer the taxes thing for a moment.
Okay.
Mr. President.
Well, we've had this discussion before.
The idea that in order to reduce the deficit, right, there has to be revenue in addition to cuts.
There has to be revenue in addition to cuts. Now, Governor Romney has ruled out revenue. He's ruled out revenue.
Absolutely.
Completely.
Okay, so, the revenue I get is by more people working, getting higher pay, paying more taxes. That's how we get growth and how we balance the budget. Right.
It indeed wasn't an amazing performance from Barack Obama. From Pittsburgh, we are indeed joined by political communications expert Dr. Gerald R. Shuster. Do you agree with our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield on what he said earlier? And what do you think happened in the beginning of October? One could easily assume that Barack Obama should know his lessons.
Well, there's no question that Barack Obama did not perform up to standard and certainly did not perform up to expectations of not only his party, but those who support him. And in particular, he must have surprised in a very positive way the opposition, because they were able to take advantage of his seemingly negativity and also his somewhat, at least by nonverbal cues, his somewhat disdain of the whole process that went on that evening. He was just not prepared, and he was not the standard Barack Obama. He was aloof from the whole process, and it certainly didn't do him well, because it allowed the campaign of Mitt Romney to take off to the point where today one of the most trusted polls indicate that this is a toss-up election, especially in the key swing states.
Well, I think as the word Gerald uses there, that's a person is aloof. Yeah, you know, Marcus, if I was to say to you, you've got brown hair, and then you sort of just said, oh, look, we've had this debate before, Steve, you know, without pointing out that actually you're blonde. And if I then started to say, you know, where you're from, Marcus, in Sweden, and you just ignored the fact that actually you're from Finland, and you just assumed that most people are going to know that anyway, you know, you're letting me dictate the terms of the debate. And that's what, you know, what Obama did with Romney. And as Gerald says, it's made it. I mean, I don't agree that it's completely become a toss-up. I think Obama still has an edge, about a 60-40 edge. But he needs a good, solid debate performance, to really sort of bring himself back into the game.
Let's have another clip.
Jim, we've gone on a lot of topics there, and so it's going to take a minute to go from Medicaid to schools
to Medicaid,
oil to tax breaks and companies going overseas. Right. So let's go through them one by one. First of all, the Department of Energy has said the tax break for oil companies is too.
That was from the beginning of October as well. Stevie said earlier that this evening's debate is going to be in town hall. It's going to be different from what we had in the beginning of October. How is it going to be different, and how should Obama get prepared for this differently?
Well, I think what he has to not do is try and refight the first debate and think, well, I let him get away with stuff. Here's the moment where I try and hit him back for everything that I didn't hit him back with in the first one. Because it's basically you're going to be sat on stools, or certainly the last town hall debate they did, they were sat on stools. There's questions from the audience, with real voters. It's not really the format where you want to be coming across as too aggressive. Having said that, you know, there are two things he has to mention when it comes to domestic policy. One, he has to mention Romney's 47% comment, you know, that 47% of the country view themselves as victims. Has to bring that up. The other thing he has to bring up is Romney's taxes. The fact that he won't release his tax returns, and those taxes that we do know show that he pays a rate of around 14%, far lower than most Americans.
Dr. Gerald R. Shuster, what kind of advice would you give to Barack Obama when he's getting prepared for tonight?
Well, he has to understand that he has to go on even keel and even be much more assertive. I'm careful to avoid the word aggressive, but he has to be much more assertive than he was first time out. If you contrast and compare the vice presidential debate with the first presidential debate, you notice that Vice President Biden never allowed the vice presidential candidate Ryan to get off the ground, and that's pretty much what Obama has to do too. He has to stand up for what he just said. And I certainly agree with Steve that one of the things that he has to do is remind the nation of his comment about the 47%. But in addition to that, he has to bring up the vagueness of some of the policies proposed by Mitt Romney. And if he doesn't, if he allows Mitt Romney's major proposals to go unchallenged in terms of specifics, he's digging his own hole deeper, and he cannot allow that to occur this time.
One thing I just want to add here is what confused me actually most about the last debate is that, you know, before these debates happen, you know, candidates and their team, they sit around and think, OK, what is the message that we want to get over tonight? What are the three main things, say, that we want to do? And you would have assumed that one of them would be, we want to make sure that we paint Mitt Romney as a right-wing, out-of-touch man, you know, who can't, you know, who this country can't afford to be president. And yet he did nothing to try and paint that picture. And I think at least on this one, he will be trying to, you know, make sure that he sticks to his game plan, whatever that game plan may be.
How much is this about confidence as well, considering that many think that Mitt Romney won the debate last time? Could one assume that he is going to have a better position when they go for this night's debate?
Well, typically he goes in with a better feeling of confidence, or at least he should, than he did first time out. But that by no means denigrates the possibility that Barack Obama, particularly in this kind of environment where it's a little more spontaneous, a little more folksy, because there will be questions coming from the audience, and the moderator is not likely to have the same level of control that Martha Raddatz had from ABC during the last, the vice presidential debate. She's not going to, or should not, be able to insert herself. And if either Obama or Romney allow the moderator to do that, then one or the other is going to suffer as a result, because those follow-up questions are often critical. And, you know, they're sometimes not prepared. I think the other thing that has to happen for this evening is that somebody on Barack Obama's staff needs to talk really tough to him, and they forget about the fact that sometimes he gives the appearance like, I know what I'm supposed to do. It's that, no, you don't, and here's what you have to do if you're going to do anything to counteract what occurred the first time out. And you know what? He cannot rely on what the possibilities are with regard to his innate talent. It's going to take more than talent tonight. It's going to take really rock-hard cramming and preparedness to overcome what happened first time.
It's going to be an interesting evening in New York indeed. Thank you very much, political communications expert Dr. Gerald R. Shuster, and our own foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. It's 17 minutes past the top of the hour, and you are listening to Midori House.
If you like Subways, not Subway sandwiches, if you want to know what makes a metropolis thrive or take a dive, and if you prefer the concrete jungle to the muddy field, then you need The Urbanist. Join me, Andrew Tuck, as we explore the urban landscape by tram, subway and taxi to meet the people out to make urban life even better. The latest episode of The Urbanist is all about tourism. We're going to find out what makes a city work for a tourist and one with an urbanist bent. We're going to meet Jeremy Hildreth, who's going to tell us about ad campaigns for cities, and Tom Burgess Watson's going to tell us what it's like to live with the Eiffel Tower in your back garden.
I drive past this structure every day at least once, sometimes several times in one day. And the only time I really take note of its presence is when the Tour Eiffel does its electric light shimmy at night.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily, with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture and business. Hear from experts, authors and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
You
You're listening to Midori House. Brazil has grown rapidly during the last decades, both in the terms of its population and its international influence, but this growth may be about to stop. Brazilians' birth rate has been dropping so much that by 2030, Brazilians will be talking about a population implosion instead of a population explosion. Where will this lead, and are the Brazilians going to do anything to stop this development and to push the citizens to get more babies? Well, to tell us more, I have Bruno Garces, Monocle's Brazilian contributor, joining me on the phone. Hello, Bruno.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. 50 years ago, Brazilian women had 6 children in average, and now they have less than 2 each, and this number is expected to drop even further. Is this the same story that we have seen elsewhere? Higher education rate, meaning that less babies get born?
That and other factors as well. I'd say a rapid industrialization process in which a big chunk of the Brazilian population went from the interior to the more, to the big urban centers. There's the factor that with, in the last decade or a little bit more than that even, with over 40 million families being lifted out of poverty via poverty alleviation schemes, it's no longer seen by less affluent families that having a bigger family is a source of income as well. It's no longer necessary to turn to this kind of thing. So, I mean, there are a series of things, cultural factors, there are economic ones, Brazil, and this demographic implosion that you mentioned is a reflex of all these massive changes that Brazil is undergoing.
A Brazilian demographer has already said that this development took, for example, England 120 years to happen, and basically this thing has now happened in Brazil in 40 years. Why has this change happened so quickly in Brazil?
Well, like I said, it's a combination of factors. I mean, you also have now a very determining one, which is the fact that Brazil has a booming middle class, people being lifted out of poverty, being brought into the consumer market, and willing and wishing to assimilate the values and the ways of this more affluent class that they've seen on TV via the telenovelas, the very highly popular telenovelas, in advertising and even in their day-to-day. I mean, there's you see a lot of that with the so-called Class C now starting to subscribe to newspapers, not necessarily because they're interested in the content, but because they see it as a symbol of status. And it's also somewhat a more middle class, if you will, symbol to have a family of less kids.
Bruno, it's funny that you mentioned telenovelas, because I was about to ask next if there is something that television would have to do with this whole thing. I've learned this far already, that telenovelas have a lot of power in Brazil.
Oh, yes, I think definitely. And as we were talking before, this is a massive change that is due to many factors, one of them being cultural. And you see, people aspiring to those role models that they see on television, which are the kind of nucleus family, a type of risking giving away my age, kind of a Brady Bunch kind of family type. So, they aspire to that model with a family, an affluent family with 2-3 children, and they wish to replicate that in their day-to-day lives.
Bruno, it sounds like Brazil would now really need a new telenovela that would have big families. Do you think that would work there?
Maybe that could play a part. Who knows?
Are the officials worried about this development?
Well, I haven't seen many public statements on this. I think Brazil is riding on this positive tide and taking so much. But Brazilians are very proud and very full of themselves from time to time. And at the moment, I think they're riding on this positive tide, which is going to last for at least 4 more years with World Cup and Olympics. So, but if this growing trend, of course, will take its toll and will and might pose some concern for the authorities. It has to be seen what measures, if any, they will take.
Can you say how Brazil would change, indeed, if someday the population would go in decline?
Well, maybe it will. Well, given the fact that Brazil is also starting to prosper a little bit, maybe, who knows, it'll resemble somewhat Western Europe from now on.
And what would this development, having less Brazilians, what would that do to the country's global influence?
Well, I think I don't see necessarily as the influence of Brazil waning because of that. I think it's not necessarily that. I don't think that. Well, China's influence has, of course, a big connection with their huge population, because they pose a huge consumer market for goods elsewhere. But I don't think necessarily that would pose a threat to Brazil's influence worldwide. But as we were saying just a while ago, it remains to be seen what are the developments of that, how that will influence Brazil's stand in the world, amongst other things, of course.
Thank you. That was Monocle's rather optimistic contributor, Bruno Garces. After Brazil, we move on to the new ways of explaining the philosophy of art. It's 26 minutes past the top of the hour. A group of art educators at the Fondazione Baile Museum in Switzerland have taken a creative approach to teaching the philosophy of art. Instead of deciding amongst themselves what should and should not be on the curriculum, they asked their students what questions they have about art. The result is the book What is Art? 27 questions, 27 answers. The book asks everything from what would life be without art to is graffiti art. Joining me on the line now from Basel is Stefanie Bringetzu, art education assistant who helped develop the concept for the book. Thank you for joining Midori House. Could you first tell us, where did this idea stem from, asking the students what they want to know versus the educators deciding what they should know?
Yeah, hi. Yes, the idea came from our experience we got from working with students in the museum in our art education programs, where we realized that they have a lot of questions which reach beyond what is this artwork about. And and then we checked the market and we found that there are many, many books that serve as kind of an introduction into the art world, but they are mostly for adults or for young children, really. And so we decided we would like to do a book for people from the age of 15 onwards, or maybe even older people, grown-ups who do not have such a big knowledge about art, or have the same questions, maybe like a 15-year-old.
Were any of the students' questions surprising?
Yes, indeed. I think the most surprising and one of the best really was whether Andy Warhol did like tomato soup. That was my favorite, really.
It must have taken a bit of work to find out all the answers.
Yes.
What other questions did you have over there?
Maybe something like, which is quite a normal question, why is the Mona Lisa so famous? A lot of people wonder why. Or, you said, is graffiti art? That was something a lot of them were interested in. And we had the students choose from the question we collected. Like, we had about 150 questions after working with five classes from different schools around Basel. And we had them then choose the 28 questions, really, that they found most important. Like, the 28th is the title question, What is Art? And the 27 questions are the other ones.
Did you include Warhol question in those 27 questions?
Yeah, that one with the tomato soup. Yes,
brilliant.
<did.
laughs> And who did you get to answer these questions?
We did a lot of research and asked a lot of people that we knew from the art field, but This one title question, what is art, we thought is not something we would like to answer because we thought there is not one comprehensive answer to this, but we decided to hand it over to experts from the field and really ask their opinion. And we chose 15 Swiss experts like a curator, conservator, gallerist, also a museum guard and a collector, of course artists, but also six pupils from a Basel high school who have specialized in art as one of their A-level subjects, and we asked for their opinion, and these opinions were quite different and sometimes very refreshing.
Were there any questions that were particularly difficult to answer?
Yeah, I mean the Andy Warhol question was not that easy, although he talks about eating campus soup all the time, but we couldn't really find out whether tomato soup was his favorite. Why are most famous artists men is maybe a question which is still not really answered, and put us into a lot of trouble finding out some kind of answer. Or what's the most spectacular art robbery? You could argue about that. There are many art robberies, and there's maybe the most famous one, the Mona Lisa, but also in Switzerland some years ago there was a quite fascinating art robbery, also because now at last I think all works stolen have returned to Switzerland, which is great. And there was a lot of things to find out for us too. We learned a lot by doing this book.
Thank you very much. That was Stephanie Bringesu, compiler of What is Art? 27 Questions, 27 Answers in Basel. The book will be available in English, French, German and Italian. In the next half hour of this program, we'll be talking to author Vicky Price about her new books, Greekonomics. We'll also be finding out what design editor Hugo MacDonald's favorite moments are in 1 year of Monocle 24. But first, here is Bill Bingham with the news headlines.
Two people have been arrested at the hospital in Birmingham where the Pakistani schoolgirl, Malala Yousafzai, shot in the head by the Taliban, is being treated. Staff say they pretended to be related to her. Malala's doctors say they're impressed with her strength and resilience. She's making good progress, but she has a long way to go. John Daly, the European Union's Commissioner for Health, has resigned after an inquiry linked him with attempts to influence tobacco laws. The EU's anti-fraud office has found a businessman from Malta had tried to use his contacts with Mr. Daly, who is also Maltese, for financial gain. US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says she takes responsibility for failures in security that led to the deaths of four Americans in Libya last month. The Benghazi assault and the Obama administration's response has become a contentious election topic, and Mrs. Clinton's comments come a day before the second presidential debate. Family and lawyers for the British computer hacker accused by the US of causing damage to American military systems have welcomed Britain's refusal to extradite him. British Home Secretary Theresa May announced her decision in the House of Commons, saying there was a high risk he could kill himself. Gary McKinnon has admitted hacking into the Pentagon and NASA computers, but he said he was looking for evidence of UFOs. A US court has quashed the conviction of Osama bin Laden's former driver, who'd been jailed in Guantanamo Bay for giving material support to terrorism. The appeals court ruled Salim Hamdan's offence did not constitute a war crime. He was freed in Yemen in 2009. Former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic says he should be rewarded for reducing suffering, not accused of carrying out war crimes. He's told a court at The Hague he's a tolerant man who'd sought peace in Bosnia. Switzerland has blocked access to nearly 1 billion Swiss francs, that's around 1.07 billion US dollars, in stolen assets. The funds were linked to dictators in four countries at the centre of the Arab Spring. And on the subject of art still, thieves have made off with paintings by Picasso, Matisse, Monet and other famous modern artists from a museum in Rotterdam. Paintings by Gauguin, Lucian Freud and Meyer de Haan were also taken from Rotterdam's Kunsthal Museum overnight. And that's the latest Monocle 24 news at the bottom of the hour.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24. Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monaco 24.
Shandai, Efrognewid, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monaco 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
You are back with Midori House on Monaco 24. We are coming to you live from London. What to do with Greece? Should it be kicked out from the Eurozone or kept there? The way Greece has been perceived during the recent years has not been too kind. There has been reports on Greece's widespread institutional corruption and accounts on the Greek regarding paying tax as a mere option. Monaco 24 listeners may still remember the news on a Greek island that claimed benefits by declaring that 90% of its inhabitants were blind. Despite all this, our next guest still believes that Greece should be kept on the Eurozone. Vicky Price, author of Greekonomics, The Euro Crisis and Why Politicians Don't Get It. Welcome to Midori House.
Thank you.
Could you start by telling us about the background of this book? You say that you realized that you had to write this book after realizing that you had that no one else seems to have anything good to say about the Greeks.
Well, it's actually quite difficult to have quite a lot of good things to say about the Greeks right now, I have to admit. But nevertheless, there is quite a lot that I found that I could say, which is basically that Greece has found itself in a rather impossible position when the crisis hit Europe, because it had nothing to fall back on. And of course, everything that it had expected would be happening ad infinitum, so that the euro would be a great help to it. Interest rates would always stay low. There would be absolutely no concern about buying foreign goods rather than investing at home. All that proved to be wrong, because basically Greece had completely forgotten that it needed to do something about its own productive capacity. Once you have no longer an exchange rate and you can't manipulate your monetary policy at all, and someone else sets it in very low, then you find that you have no real concern about whether you buy things from home or whether you import German cars. And that's what they did. And that has been a serious problem. Competitiveness suffered. But the Greeks, in a way, feel that they have been given no help to sort out their economy during the euro years. And in many ways, they have been misunderstood and have been given huge austerity packages, which have been impossible for them to implement in a hurry.
So why should Greece be kept in the eurozone?
Well, the problem now is, what do you do with places like Greece? And Greece is not actually the only one. What's going on in Spain right now, what has happened in Portugal, of course, what's going on in Cyprus and also probably Slovenia, shows that quite a lot of the periphery countries just can't cope with the demands that are being put on them, given that they didn't do very many of the structural reforms. But if Greece goes, everyone says, why don't we let it go, and then they can devalue and so on. First of all, there will be huge repercussions in Greece itself, because basically lots of people will go bankrupt. The banks will need huge bailouts. And second, there is very likely to be a contagion effect. We're already seeing it in terms of the yields that have to be paid for borrowing in Spain and Italy and the other periphery countries. There is definitely going to be a domino effect. The banking sectors are all so interconnected. A number of the other countries have similar problems in terms of high debt to GDP ratio and high deficits that they can't control. And the markets are going to punish the rest of the eurozone too. So it could possibly lead to the end of the euro project.
The name of this book is Greekonomics, The Euro Crisis and Why Politicians Don't Get It. So what is the part that the politicians don't get?
I think they don't see that the problem is urgent. They let Greece get into increasing difficulty over a couple of years. The problem could have been solved quite early on, or at least not solved, but certainly contained. Instead, they continued to argue about various bailouts. They seem to be constantly going back on agreements made in the various summits. The process towards European integration seems to be very low, one step forward, sometimes two steps back. And the markets obviously don't like it. So what I think the core country politicians haven't understood is that the periphery countries need a huge amount of help to do the structural reforms that are necessary to improve their competitiveness. The core countries benefited hugely themselves out of countries like Greece and others buying their own products. In other words, German products, French products and so on. And the core countries actually financed a lot of the boom that we've seen in those other countries, like the house building boom in Spain, which has come to an unfortunate end, and so on. So what they haven't realised is that there is a bit of give and take, that at the end of the day, the only way that the euro will survive is by the core countries repaying, if you like, the periphery countries for everything that's happened so far, and basically supporting them for a number of years so that the reforms can, in fact, take place in an environment where at least the economies are not collapsing, and the Greek economy is collapsing right now.
So are you basically asking for more money to Greece?
No, I think what everyone is asking now, and after all, the International Monetary Fund has come out to say the same right now, is that austerity of the sort that's been imposed on a number of these countries is counterproductive because it leads to even greater loss of GDP, in other words, of output. And what then happens is that you can't collect your taxes and your deficit, if anything, gets worse. And then, of course, you have the vicious circle of the economy collapsing even further. I mean, Greece has seen a 20% decline in GDP in the last 4 to 5 years. That is huge. And with that, you can't mend your economy. You can't reduce your debt to GDP ratio. And the markets would just not lend to you, or they will at a very, very high rate, which, of course, is completely unsustainable.
So what should be done?
Well, I think there has to be realization that, first of all, the terms of the austerity packages need to be extended. The IMF is now saying that too, certainly in Greece by a couple of years. And what also needs to be done is realization, which is really the title of the book as to why the Europeans don't get it, the European leaders. We have to write off a lot of the debt. It will never be repaid. So we might as well accept that there will need to be more haircuts. In other words, there will be more write-offs of debt, and people will have to accept the losses. And not only in Greece, but actually, I think, in Spain and elsewhere.
What kind of advice would you give to Greece itself? We all know that the country has a massive corruption problem.
Oh, Greece needs to change very dramatically. I'm saying all this not thinking that necessarily Greece have got it right. In fact, the politicians have a lot to answer for. There is no doubt there is a huge corruption problem. But of course, people don't really believe in their government. And what they are saying is, why should we be paying taxes, for example, for a government which is going to use the money we pay to just buy votes? We really want a government that we can trust. So it has to be a two-way thing. The Greeks need to change, but the government needs to also demonstrate that it is serious about tax avoidance, about eliminating some of the very bad practices of the past, improving bureaucracy, and allowing the economy to actually grow again. And we're not at that stage yet.
It's refreshing to hear someone being even slightly on Greece's side. How much does it affect your thinking that you were born in that country?
Well, obviously, probably quite a lot, in the sense that I feel for it. The interesting thing about the debates that have been going on in the UK and the rest of Europe is that they forget the human aspect of it. In reality, those countries that have gone through this very sort of steep sort of decline have seen living standards collapse, have seen the whole social cohesion in put in doubt, really. The protests demonstrate that up to a point, but you can feel the despair in a number of those places. And what worries me more than anything else is that this despair will be translated, as we're already seeing in Greece, in the rise of very extreme parties, both on the right and on the left. And at the end of the day, we might actually see the end of democracy in some of those countries, which, of course, only joined the EU after they got rid of their own military dictators.
That was Vicky Price, author of Greekonomics, The Euro Crisis and Why Politicians Don't Get It. Thank you very much for visiting Midori House. We'll be right back after this with a preview of the next issue of Monocle Magazine's design section.
The Entrepreneurs is a show about inspiring startups, innovative business models and smart CEOs. It's about good ideas and the people with the business acumen to make them into the brands of tomorrow.
Character, your vision, your courage, all this are necessary to become a leader.
On the latest episode, we speak to an Austrian boatmaker who's gone green, chat with venture capitalist Tony Chan about his new book, and review a Finnish wristwatch company with military heritage.
If you happen to buy one, if you want to come and pick it up from Finland, we'll take you on a flight so you can test it yourself.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Monocle 24 is growing. We're proud to introduce The Stack, a new program on air every Saturday. This lively one-hour show is a celebration of the print media, exploring the best in periodicals, niche journals and newspapers, and talking to people from around the world who are pushing the sector forward and shaping the media landscape. Running on Saturdays at 10 a.m. UK time and repeated on Sundays, the show is an intimate conversation around a coffee table stacked with interesting magazines and newspapers from around the globe, hosted by Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brûlé. That's The Stack, every Saturday morning at 10 a.m. UK time, repeated on Sundays and available online. Brought to you in association with J.Crew.
It is 18:45 in London and you are listening to Midori House. The new print issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or at least now about. Issue 58 of Monocle focuses on health, introducing the people and ideas which will hopefully help us all live longer and better. And joining me now to talk me through it is Monocle's design editor, Hugo MacDonald. Hello, Hugo.
Hello, Marcus.
What are you particularly excited about this month when we talk about Section D on the magazine?
Well, the design section, I sort of tackled exactly what you just said in the introduction there, the fact that we're all living longer. And I looked at innovative ways that people are approaching how to deal with their ageing populations around the world. We started with a fantastic enterprise in Sao Paulo in Brazil, which is a privately run, best described as a kindergarten, really, where families drop off their elderly relatives at the beginning of the day. And for 30 euros, they get entertained, looked after, taught various skills, fed, they can shower, they can have a sleep. And then people come and pick them back after they've done a day's work. Fantastic, amazing thing that is being picked up by the Brazilian government and soon to be rolled out further across Brazil. We also look at an amazing old people's community in Japan, which, of course, no surprise, has the sort of highest grey population of any country in the world, and so is maybe a little bit more adept at dealing with them. And then we visit Lund University in Sweden, where there is a whole course devoted to how to design for old people, because despite the fact that elderly population is the fastest growing sector of the population around the world, design really hasn't done very much to tackle it.
So, you know, basing on all what you have compiled on this month's edition of Monocle, what can you tell about the future?
The future is bright. I mean, we, in our Monocle way, then spoke to six architects around the world whose work we favour for whatever reason. And together with their help, enlisted their advice on what the perfect old age community should consist of, and did this wonderful gatefold illustration called Monocle Springs, which really incorporates all the best elements that we would have in sort of not unrealistic community. It includes everything from a petting zoo to beautiful thermal baths, hot springs. Obviously, the location of where these places would be built is very particular. This one is built in Hawaii, or that's where we've chosen to build our first one. But we're also looking at places in Kamakura on Japan's coast and Great Barrier Island in New Zealand too. And then we have sort of little details on the back of the gatefold as well about what the houses would consist of, the little sort of treats and services that are on offer. I can see your eyes lighting up at the fact that there are many beauty salons there.
No, it was the bottle of wine that's on
the bottle of wine,
page 130.
Red wine is supposedly very, very good for old people. It helps keep your memory intact.
So, Hugo MacDonald, our section editor, out of all the features you have found regarding the future of elderly care, when you think of yourself after 90 years, you know, in the future...
Red wine plays a very big part.
Is it red wine? I was just going to ask, which thing is it that's the most important?
No, wine, chocolates and tomatoes, apparently, very good for old people.
What about furry friends, as it's mentioned?
Furry friends, the petting zoo, it's as much for the grandchildren who come to visit the grandparents. As for the grandparents themselves, you know, people feel lonely a lot of the time. I think when they're old, it's nice to have a giraffe to pat every now and then.
I love that idea. That was Hugo MacDonald, our design editor. And actually, we continue with you, Hugo, as we look back to October last year soon. Tomorrow marks the first anniversary of Monocle 24, and during the past year, we have had a big number of musicians performing Midori House sessions here in London. And Hugo, I already know what your favourite performance has been this far, but would you still want to introduce this song?
Yes, please. It was really a highlight the whole of the last year when one of my childhood icons, Charlene Spiteri from Texas, popped by Midori House and played a gig just for us. This was her singing Inner Smile from December last year.
Something like loving. You took me in so soon. You took my feelings, but nothing came back at noon. Just maybe I'm ready to show myself to you. So if I lose my patience, you must try to understand. Try to understand if I lose my patience. Oh yeah, 'cause you make me feel, yeah. You make me feel wild. You keep going, yeah. You touch my inner smile. You got me in the mood. So come on and make your move and free me. Make my wishes as much as your kisses make me blue. If I'm a river, where will you skate away to? Just maybe I'm ready. Falling into you. So if I lose my patience, you must try to understand. Try to understand if I lose my patience. Oh yeah, 'cause you make me feel, yeah, 'cause you make me feel why. You touch my inner smile. You got me in the mood. So come on and make it your mood and free me. Free me, yeah. Free me, yeah. Whoa, 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 yeah, yeah. You make me feel, yeah, 'cause you make me feel wild. You touch my inner smile. You got me in the mood. So come on and make your move and touch my inner smile. Come get my to be alone. There's times I need for you to fall. Sometimes you make me feel so high. There's times I ask myself why.
That was Charlene Spiteri with Inner Smile. Hugo, did I hear your voice in the background screaming?
Yes. Quite possibly. She touched my inner smile that night.
It's funny that I chose this song because it happens to be one of my favourite performances as well. It's 7 minutes to the top of the hour. You are listening to Midori House with me, Marco Sippi, and our design editor Hugo MacDonald is in the studio one of Midori House as well. Tomorrow will mark 1 year of Monocle 24 Radio. That is 8,784 hours of broadcasting. And now me and Hugo, well, Hugo mostly is going to recall the past year. Let's start from the very beginning. Do you remember when it was the first time we actually realised that it is going to happen, Monocle is going to go and launch a global 24/7 radio station?
I can remember being in Seoul with Tyler in February at the beginning of last year, and he was going off for a meeting and I was sitting and I can't remember, we were chatting and sort of just about to part ways, and his laptop's open and there was a presentation of what Monocle 24 was going to look like. And he'd spoken about it before, but I think it was only at that point that I realised that, OK, this is really definitely happening. And then when we moved into this building, only a few weeks later, he pointed at where we're now sitting in the studios that was then a big storage room, dusty, empty storage room used as a bit of a dumping ground when we moved in, and said that that was going to be the radio studios. That's where Monocle 24 would happen. And even then, I wasn't entirely sure. I thought, you know, this is very ambitious. It might be a couple of years rather than a couple of months before we see this.
And then a couple of months later, you know, I came here.
You came, and then I thought, oh my goodness, this is the beginning of the end.
Well, 1 year later, what are some of your favourite moments of Monocle 24?
Well, it's difficult because obviously there are so many, but the ones that stick in my mind was I was in Japan doing a whistle stop tour, doing the Japan travel guide for the February issue of Monocle. And I was in Kagoshima, which is a city right down in the southern tip of Kyushu, and phoned Steve Bloomfield live doing The Globalist to tell him a little bit about my travels. I think we've got a clip of that.
I understand that there's lots of Christmas lights already up in Tokyo as well.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I know that the energy saving ban was lifted a couple of months ago, but
just in time for Christmas.
Just in time for Christmas. Well, they've really come out with force, and really there are Christmas lights absolutely everywhere, and there's even an inflatable Father Christmas that sings Tikka Tikka by ABBA from its tummy.
From its tummy?
From its tummy. It's almost as disconcerting as the volcano erupting.
Oh, I think that's more disconcerting.
That was you in Japan.
It was. Another highlight was in April when, for the annual Salone del Mobile Furniture Fairs, we took Monocle 24 on the road and presented the Globalist live for four mornings consecutively. We have a clip of that too, I think. Coming up in the next hour, we'll talk brand Italy with Marco Velardi, founder of Appartamento magazine and creative director of De Padova. He'll be joining me live in the studio. We'll enjoy some of the sights and sounds on day one of the furniture fair as we meet some young designers who have their eyes set on an industrial scale business. And what was amazing about that was the fact I've been to the Salone del Mobile for 7-8 years, and to actually cover it for radio was a completely different experience.
You could do it straight away.
Well, don't know. It wasn't so much that. It was more the feat of persuading four guests to get up at 6 o'clock every morning in what is traditionally a massive party and the biggest time of the year for the design industry. But it was fascinating. I saw a completely different side of, well, the power of radio to cover a live event like that. And we've since sort of gone on and taken Monocle 24 on the road elsewhere many times, including during the Olympics, actually, where we went to another one of my favourite times, to Korea House during the Olympics for Midori House Live.
And we do have audio of that as well.
You're listening to a special edition of Midori House. It's an Olympic session, Hugo.
Yes, it is.
Shall we let the cat out of the bag? Today we're experiencing a taste of Korean culture at the Royal Thames Yacht Club in London, and it's the strangest conflict
Well, there's a lot to take in, isn't there?
Should we first set the scene? What's one of the most favourite things we love about Korea? It's K-pop.
Exactly, and we're joined here by a massive troupe of K-pop fans.
It sounds like you had fans there.
We had about 150 K-pop teenage fans, and we were dressed in Korean royal national dress for the whole show as well.
Why didn't you keep up with that style after that show?
It was very synthetic. Yeah, me and Rob stank by the end of it, but that aside, it was a great memory.
Monocle 24 is going to turn 1 year tomorrow. Hugo, how are you going to celebrate that?
I probably might have a drink. I'll be lying if I said it was going to be a soft drink.
I think I may do the same thing, you know. Thank you very much, Hugo MacDonald, and happy first anniversary.
And to you too.
That's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer, Hannah Jenkins, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Sam Impey. Up next, after the news, is a new episode of Section D. Today, we'll meet a Shanghai gallerist with the best hair in the design industry, and here is a bit of a preview.
There is this very nice corner on the main room. Actually, it's the only natural light that comes in. It's a little triangle in the corner of the former stage, which is now an open space.
And in 3 hours' time, that's at 2200 hours here in London, me and Andrew Müller will be back for the Monocle Daily. And I will also be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.